that's it. I'd like to be like to speak to us for something like 10 minutes, if that's okay.
Thank you very much. I'm here basically as a citizen of Ireland, not as a retired army officer, a member of the Decent Anti-Tanks, which I am, or a member of the Shannon Peace Camp, which I am as well. I'm here as a citizen of Ireland, and as such, I have taken the case against the government of Ireland, in fact against Antichuk, Minister for Foreign Affairs, Minister for Transport, Ireland itself, the government of Ireland, and the Attorney General. So I'm going to watch you. Hopefully had a serious coercion. Now, I'd have to be circumspect tonight because the case is effectively still before the court. I was in court on Monday and the judge found primarily against my case. He did find in one respect that we had a case in one respect. I am before the court again on Friday next. A small matter of cost. Obviously, that has some importance for me. If one is taking a case like this, there are some advantages in being a person of law. In other words, the unemployed have no property and have nothing which the state can hit you at. I'm fortunately or unfortunately not in that position. We will be obviously be fighting the issue of cost in court, and there is also the other issue as to whether the case will be appealed to the Supreme Court. You can read between the lines of what I'm saying, but we won't be deciding on that officially until next week. But obviously there is a possibility we will be appealing the case to the Supreme Court. The case itself, I have over the last couple of weeks. In fact, the case went ahead very quickly. The government made its decision on the 19th of March, and the Dáil voted on that on the 20th of March. I think that was probably Wednesday. On Thursday, I had some discussions with John Moon and my solicitor. We decided basically on Thursday to take the case. We walked Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, a good chunk of Sunday night into Monday morning, and we had the case before the High Court. In fact, it was sent to the High Court at 10:30 on Monday. So it was put together that quickly, and I would have to say I have huge admiration for the legal team who put the case together, because even though we haven't won this little leg of it, there was absolutely no fault on the legal team. They did provide and present what I would consider a brilliant case in a very short period of time, and I obviously have already told them that, and if I need them further, I'm sure they are an excellent team. Again, it was a reasonably large team with 3 senior counsellors, 2 juniors, and solicitors also on the team, and other individuals who have dealt on the side. So it's a daunting task to take on to compete government apparatus. And as I say, I'm still in the middle of the storm. I am very pleased, actually, it was a very difficult decision. I have an equally difficult decision to make over the coming weekend, in which I would have to decide whether to take the stage or not. And as I say, the issue of cost, which is now before me next Friday, is one which will concentrate my mind a little bit like hangman's rope, but I won't necessarily falter with that one either. The case itself is obviously a very complex one. Actually, Lord Fulton in the Irish Times gives a very good and accurate description of our case and of the judge's finding on it. So the judge's finding itself, in fact, runs through 71 pages. I won't put you all to sleep here now, I'm going through that. And the case itself, it went on for 4 full days. I have copies of the transcripts, and they are run to about 600 pages. So again, I won't put you into a coma by reading out those to you. It's probably best maybe if I can answer questions either immediately afterwards or later. procedures on the next stage of the case if there is to be a next stage. There were three attacks basically in my case against the state. Article 28 of the Constitution, Article 29 of the Constitution, and international law. Maybe if you look at it a little bit like a three-legged stool. I come from a farming background, and we used to use three-legged stools for milking the cows in the old days, before we were technologically advanced with milking machines. A three-legged stool is very stable, because it won't rock. On the other hand, it's important, if you break one leg, you can't listen to the stool. Three legs in our stool basically are that what was happening at Shannon Airport was contrary to the international law rules on neutrality. Regardless of how we define neutrality or undefine it as being flexible or whatever, or developing, there are very clear procedures in international law which describe what a neutral country must do. And there has been a lot of arguments about what we did or didn't do during the Second World War and in the meantime. And some of that is actually bogus argument. The basic rule of neutrality in international law is if you're not a participant in a war, you are, by default, a neutral country. And in such a situation, you are, our country is obliged to behave as a neutral country. Quite clearly, one of the things in international law you cannot do is allow large numbers of troops to pass through your country on their way to a war, and which troops not participating in a war. By doing that, you are effectively, I would strongly argue, participating in that war. Strangely enough, the judgment yesterday did find on that issue that effectively the what was happening in Shannon is and was contrary to international law as regards the laws of neutrality. And that is a very important finding. It decides, in my view, it is a High Court decision that Ireland is no longer neutral. And I think people should read that particular clause in the finding and read it very carefully. Ireland, right now, as a result of the involvement, I won't use the word participation because that hasn't been legally clarified as yet. Quite clearly, it is my opinion that Ireland did participate in the war against Iraq. That war was, I believe, a highly unjust war, a highly immoral war, and in that line, it was clearly, in my view, contrary to Article 59 of our Constitution, which is one of the legs of our argument. The judge in the High Court decided that Article 29 of the Constitution isn't a strong legal article, that it's purely, what do you say,
aspirational.
Yeah, aspirational. Now, it means, if that is the case and is borne out, it means a very important section of our Constitution is meaningless. And obviously, there are arguments in favour of having that decided at a higher level. And again, that would be a decision I would be making over the weekend. Article 28 of the Constitution, again, it's one of the things also that's important to remember. Neutrality isn't either mentioned in the Constitution or copper fastened in our Constitution. It's a policy of the Irish government. Neutrality applies in time of war only. And again, the Irish government is free to decide that Ireland should not be neutral. The only thing it has to do is to inform the Dáil and get the Dáil's approval for involvement in a war. On the 20th of March last, the government decided to ask the Dáil to tell it and tell the people that what was happening in Shannon is not participation in a war. And again, it would be important for you to read that Dáil resolution. Again, I haven't time to read it here. I'll copy it here if you want to see it afterwards. But what the Dáil resolution, by a majority of the Dáil, stated, in spite of evidence of the country, in my view, that what was happening in Shannon was not participation in the war against Iraq. It then went on to say, in another paragraph, in contradiction of that, that what was happening in Shannon was only a continuation of what has been happening since for the last 55 years. Again, I would argue very strongly that was actually a false statement, and that's a very strong language to use. Clearly, the judge in his decision actually supported that contention in saying that what was happening in Shannon is at the very least contrary to international law on neutrality. And that, in my view, is involvement, is participation in a war. So there are those points which come out clearly. The Dáil Éireann then went on to say that in spite of the of those facts, or because of the facts allegedly, that what we're doing in Shannon is not involvement in a war, it's only a continuation of what we're doing for the last 55 years. The Dáil then decided to support the government's decision to continue with what has been happening in Shannon for the last 50 years and to continue with the present arrangements allowing US troops to use Shannon. Quite clearly, in my view, and in the detailed case which was submitted to the High Court, what was happening in Shannon never applied before in time of war. And the quotations which were produced both by the Minister of Foreign Affairs and others, and by the government in their defence, suggested that they mentioned the Korean War, which of course was actually a UN war. It mentioned the war in Vietnam, even though from the long term of the war. And if you look at a map, it would be completely idiotic to send American troops to Vietnam to Ireland. It would be like going to Cork via Belfast from Dublin. Those kinds of applications, of course. The three legs of our case were Article 28, in which the government must, after all, participate in a war. Quite clearly, it did not. In fact, it quite clearly said, we are not participating in a war, and they got the goal to say so. Then they went on to say, we will continue to participate, but they didn't use the word participate in the war by allowing US troops to Shannon. So I think I would ask people to study very carefully, get a copy of the Dáil resolution and ask yourself, who's fooling who? And are we, the people, being literally misled, and I'm putting it very mildly and very carefully, I'm using the word misled, by our political representatives. And again, I leave it to you to judge that one for the moment. Time is running short. Obviously, I have a huge amount of information in my head and at home in my briefcases on this whole case. I would have to say that I have a huge appreciation for Irish law, for the Irish legal system. I know other people have taken cases and they have been very critical and they have called the Irish legal system corrupt. I am not of that opinion. I believe the Irish legal system is a very sound legal system. I believe the Irish constitution is a very sound constitution. I am defending an important part of it. And it has been a great honour for me to put all to be allowed, take the case very quickly to the courts. And in spite of the judge's decision, we were treated with respect in court. The case was given very careful hearing, and the judge is obviously quite entitled, and I respect his decision. I don't necessarily agree with it, and that may well be the next stage of the case and this particular court I'm on at the moment. Without too much more ado, I obviously can't explain the complete details of the case. It runs to a huge, several volumes at this stage, and as I say, may run through some more. So thank you very much for the moment.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much. I'm going to invite Ivana to speak to us. Do we have a speaker from PANA? Roger Corbett's going to send a representative, but okay. So Ivana will then speak to us, and then we'll have questions and discussion about the cases against the state. So if you'd like to address us.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Robin, for the invitation, and thanks also for the opportunity to hear Ed describe his case, and really respect the bravery that he's taking it on. I think it's very difficult, and I know because I've been before the court both as a litigant in the past and more recently as a lawyer. So I think it is often quite intimidating to be before the court, and particularly when you're actually suing the state, to be put in that position. And I know the costs are really the stick with which litigants are often beaten, and that's the reality. And so when using litigants before our court, unfortunately, you're generally ordered to pay the winner's costs as well as their own. And that's really what puts off people, as Ed described. What I wanted to do first was just talk briefly about the international law aspects of the war in Iraq, and then maybe just speak briefly about Ed's case. I wasn't one of the lawyers in it, so I can talk a little more candidly about my view of it anyway. But I want to speak briefly about the invasion of Iraq, US-British invasion of Iraq, and whether it, and what its status was in international law. And of course, now we're looking back at it. And some might say, does it matter at this stage? But of course, it does matter, because it was a very important precedent. And what we saw was the US and Britain riding roughshod over principles of international law and over the Charter of the United Nations. And it's very important that we understand just how exactly the war was in breach of international law, so that we can, I think, stand up and be counted and protest in the future when, as no doubt they will, the US will, or other countries decide to take the law into their own hands again. UN Security Council Resolution 1441, passed last October, was used by the US as the basis for what they argued was the legitimacy of the war. The United Nations resolution, just to say very briefly what it was about, and most of you will be familiar with it, it established an enhanced inspection regime in order to complete a process of disarmament of Iraq. And of course it was one more in a series of resolutions aimed at uncovering the weapons of mass destruction that were allegedly in Iraq, or seen on the air. No time limit was stipulated for completion in this resolution, 1441. That's an important point, because there wasn't actually a deadline by which all weapons had to be handed up or anything like that. Paragraph 4 of the resolution states that failure by Iraq to cooperate would constitute a material breach and arms of their obligations, and armed inspectors were directed to report any such failure immediately to the Security Council. Paragraph 12 and 13 dealt with what the Security Council were then empowered to do, and that was that they were obliged to convene immediately to consider the situation and the need for full compliance. And they were called in paragraph 13 that Iraq would face serious consequences as a result of continued violations. So there was a reminder to the Council that Iraq would face those consequences, but the resolution itself did not contain the trigger for war. And in fact, at the time that it was passed, Russia, China and France all issued statements saying that they understood that the text excluded any automaticity of the use of force against Iraq. The proponents of war argued that the war was justified in any event under previous resolutions or under the UN Charter. You know, if you look at the text of Resolution 1441, because it was the latest in a series of resolutions, it clearly states notwithstanding breaches by Iraq. So it was clearly putting aside breaches and putting in place this new regime. And I think it's a very strong argument that it therefore would have bypassed or superseded previous resolutions in which the US argued there was an authorization to use the force. In terms of the UN Charter, Robin and the Fairview Group have given you some of the excerpts from the Charter of the United Nations. The whole thrust of the United Nations Charter is against war. It only authorizes military action under Chapter 7 where measures not involving the use of armed force are inadequate to secure peace. But very clearly saying war is very much a last resort. The preamble reminds us the UN was established to save succeeding generations from discouraged war. Article 2.4 prohibits the threat or use of force by any country. The whole thrust of the document is war is a last resort. There was some argument about the concept of self-defense. I think that really lacked any sort of credibility. It's an emergency self-defense under Article 51 of the Charter is an emergency response to an actual armed attack or an anticipation of an imminent attack. And again, only where the need to use force must be instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. And that was a formula actually adopted by a US Secretary of State in the 19th century that's been enshrined in international law. So there was never an argument, even by Donald Rumsfeld, that there was an imminent threat of an attack from the inbound attack from Iraq. So I think that, all of the doctrines that were used by the US at various points to try and justify the invasion really don't lack credibility and don't lack any basis in international law. Especially when you look at the context in which other member states of the Security Council were arguing for more time for arms inspection. That they weren't, if you look at France's position, for example, they weren't actually against war ever. They were saying, let's give it more time, which was very much in the spirit of the UN Charter. And ironically, now, of course, we see the US itself admitting that it would take some months for their own arms inspectors to find any weapons of mass destruction that may or may not still be in Iraq after all the bombings. Also, of course, the US has really made known its contempt for the international legal order long before this resolution was passed. If you look at some of what George Bush was saying back in September 2002, before he worked through, he started to look for a new resolution, he said, He conceded that he would work for cure cancer. He said the purposes of the United States should not be doubted. And I think there's one important point, perhaps been overlooked because the war happened so fast, which is that the final trigger that actually sparked off the invasion itself was the US giving Saddam Hussein an ultimatum to step down. And if he didn't step down, they said they would invade. Now, there is nowhere in any international law doctrine or case any sort of provision that says that you can demand the head of state in another country to step down and invade the country if you don't. So the ultimate trigger was itself fundamentally a breach of international law. I think all of us here would probably be fairly cynical in fact about US purposes in going to war, and I know that those arguments were thrashed out during the war itself, and this really appears to be about US self-interest, about dominance of the enemy in the region, about gaining control of oil reserves, about all of those, about sending off a warning to other states and so-called acts of legal. So I think that's really clear. And I think that what we've seen with the US pretending to use or appearing to use international law and then twisting it, I think the danger is that it's given them some sort of supposed legitimacy in the eyes of other countries, that it, because some people were persuaded, and if you look at some of the legal opinions that were given in Britain, for example, we see people who were persuaded that there was some legitimacy in the US-British attack. And I think the problem there is that, and the real danger for the future, is that it allows other countries, or indeed the US and Britain again, to go into countries, to invade countries, and to use force unilaterally under a sort of pretense or pretext of international law, thereby pretending that they have legitimacy. And really what we're seeing then is imperialism unchallenged, which is exactly what the United Nations and the rules of international law are all about trying to prevent. Turning then to look at our own position as participants or not, depending on your view in the war, we see as a neutral country that, you know, certainly morally, I think all of us would agree that Ireland should have been aligned with those countries on the Security Council that were actively trying to prevent the invasion, with France and with Germany and with Russia, that we were seeking more time for armed inspections and so on. The polls, in fact, showed public opinion here overwhelmingly against war. But unfortunately, our elected leaders ignored those polls and acted, ironically, according to the same motivation driving the US invasion itself, that of economic self-interest, in my view. And if you look at the statements being made by Taoiseach and Ardtáinisce around the time of the Dáil resolution in March, you see that they refer quite openly to economic self-interest, to Ireland's interest in maintaining good relationships with America and with US companies. So what was the sight of US troops pouring through town, and these were statements being made by our elected leaders, and with the terrible bombings in Iraq itself, I think all of us might well feel quite surprised about the concept of Irish neutrality. I would say, however, looking and particularly now that the Morgan's case has in fact at this stage been lost in the High Court, but I think if we look at the judgments in the Morgan case, just very briefly, but there is some ground for optimism. The first point is, as I said, he sued the state on the basis of Articles 28 and 29 of the Constitution. 28 deals with the fact that the state shall not participate in war except with without the assent. The state shall not participate in any war save with the assent of Dáil Éireann. So it envisages that the state can indeed declare war or participate in war, which is at odds really with the concept of neutrality itself. The Constitution, as you've heard, doesn't contain any guarantee of neutrality, and that's different to the constitutions of other countries, other neutral countries like Austria, for example, where neutrality is enshrined, there is a constitutional protection. Nor do we have any legal definition of neutrality contained in any legislation. So it is entirely a political concept and a policy, and a government policy. Now, Article 29 deals with the Irish state's relationship with principles of international law. On both of those grounds, the facilitation of US troops through Shannon was challenged. Judge Kearns dealt with the case. He rejected the challenge under Article 28, saying Dáil had already resolved this matter, as you've heard. And the argument is whether or not the resolution, in fact, did give assent to participation in war. If you look at the words of it, it did. However, the courts, especially in recent years, have been very concerned to preserve the separation of powers. And I think this is something one would have to be aware of in looking to perhaps trying to predict what way the Supreme Court might decide any future opinion on this basis. because they are very reluctant at the moment to intervene on what they see as the prerogative of the executive or of the legislature. And Judge Kearns, in his judgment, mentioned the circumspect role that the court must have in dealing with areas which he saw as being matters for the executive and the legislature. We might remember just recently the Lobe case, for example, where the rights of children born in this state to have their parents who are non-nationals living here was held to be less important than the right of the government to dictate immigration policy. One might just remember that, that the courts are reluctant to intervene in areas they see as not matters for the judiciary to resolve. Just on the Article 29 issue that we've heard, Judge Curran said these are statements of principle or guidelines that are aspirational, they're not prescriptive, and that they're not even justiciable by ordinary citizens. You can't rely on Article 29. Now that seems to me to be a rather odd position, because there are other guarantees in the Constitution that may appear to be declaratory in some way, and yet have been relied on by citizens before the courts. I'm not sure if that, in my view, might stand being upheld. So I think there are other points of judgment, and there's an awful lot more in it, that one might well see as reasons for hope. And I think in particular, the view Judge Kearns took, that to allow troops from a belligerent state pass through the territory of another state is clearly at odds with or in breach of international law principles of neutrality. I think that's really a key principle, which we might well use, I think, as a sort of focus for political campaigns in the future. Because I think if everything has come out of the whole terrible war in Iraq, one bright light is the fact that there was huge people power, huge movements of people on the streets, unprecedented demonstrations, and I think the government will have to wake up and listen to what we have to say about neutrality in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ivana. We're very close for time. I'm not quite sure we have to finish at 2:15, 10 or 10. Do you think it's about what time we've got? But I think we've got about just 10 minutes, if we need it, I'm sure we do, but for questions and discussion about the first session of the meeting. Has anybody got questions? Yeah.
I didn't read the Irish Times, but I did see the 9 o'clock news last night, and either I missed something or I just didn't understand that there was a significant judgment about breach of international law. So my old question is, to what extent do you think RTE is an independent media authority, or do you think that there might be some political influence there? It's slightly a side issue, but
yeah.
My own experience of the workings of RTE is that there is some political interference, that they didn't make a big issue of that significant finding, and most of the public may not be aware of it.
Yes, I would agree with you. Obviously, from my perspective, being in the centre of the case at the moment, I would be conscious that at least have formed the opinion that RTE's reporting of it was a little bit inadequate. I wouldn't put a thumb under that. And I think from the Irish Times, which I would have to say, attended the court on each day, give a very good report on each day in court, and give a very balanced report of the findings. So, and I think if, from my point of view, if you could take the Irish Times as, and would say, an excellent investigative and analysis reporting of the complete trial in the court, is a very good example and very balanced example. Obviously, subjectively, I'm probably not the best person to judge on RTE's performance, but I would agree with you. I would have some problems with the way RTE have reported.
Yeah. Given that the court did hold that under international law, and also given that Nice II was won on the principle or on the basis of the promise that neutrality was guaranteed, is it now time for this organisation to go a step forward in lobbying for a change to the Constitution to guarantee a neutrality?
Yes, on that point, I would very strongly be of the opinion that the clause we put in our constitution on these two was almost a fraudulent clause. It did anything but guarantee our neutrality. In fact, if you read that clause in particular, I haven't got it to be now, but it effectively says in a roundabout way that if there's no provision for Ireland being involved or not being involved in a war against, let's say, Iraq, but it did say in a roundabout way also that if a European Union country was attacked. Ireland couldn't actually even go to defenders by virtue of the new clause you put in our constitution. It's a very confusing, and it was put in so that the government could claim in the election, I believe, that Ireland was neutral by virtue of this clause. I think it's just the opposite. I think it is a clause almost of anti-neutrality. Yes, I would agree with you. In time, if the Supreme Court, if the case goes to the Supreme Court, and if they find in favour of Judge Kearns' decision, then obviously we must then look at the voice of the people. In my view, sovereignty is a very key issue, but sovereignty is with the people, not with the judiciary, not with the electorate or with the executive, and not with the legislature. The people in Ireland, I believe, are sovereign. You as an individual, individually and collectively, are the sovereigns. A referendum may well be a step down the road, which might be necessary to sort out what at the moment is developing into a serious mess.
I'm wondering, Ed's case was taken in on through civil courts, basically, as I understand it. And I'm wondering, especially in the light of that bit in the judgment saying that we are in breach of, or the government is in breach of international law in this aspect, and, I mean, some of us would have said that anyway, but what scope there might be within the criminal law, with, especially, we have ratified the ICC constitution. There are, as I understand it, legal definitions of war crimes within Irish law as a result of that. And I've wondered what kind of, what scope there was anyway, and how helpful that bit of Judge Kearns' decision might be.
Yeah, I mean, Judge Kearns' decision is really very much in line with the Irish Court's view of international law. First, he didn't actually look at international, he didn't look at the legality of the war in Iraq,
yeah,
international law, but that was a progressive side issue. There wasn't a direct And the second thing was that although he said that the passing troops through the country and so on was in breach of international law principles, he said the domestic law should preclude over international law principles. You can't enforce, effectively the court point said you can't enforce international law principles through the domestic court, except where they're actually brought into our law through legislation or through the constitution. So that was how that is, that was dealt with. In the sense it will have to be resolved at some stage by the Supreme Court, really. But your point about international criminal law is a good one, because really that's a separate issue. Because we ratified the International Criminal Court Charter of the International Criminal Court, and so did Britain, although the US did not, and certainly British legal groups and human rights groups have already brought forward complaints to the International Criminal Court. It's just been set up, the judge has been appointed, but not really, it's not but they've already brought complaints before the court against Tony Blair and so on, arguing that in specific instances that there's been breaches of international criminal law, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and that British troops, which were complicit in that, and that the leadership of British, people politically responsible, are therefore, can therefore be indicted. I mean, it would be, I suppose, more indirect to suggest that Irish government, that Irish government ministers might be indicted. It's certainly a potential liability, but one would have to prove a chain, One would have to prove, in other words, that the court, that the troops that passed the true challenge were themselves involved. It would be very difficult.
Is the crimes against peace and aggression not within the jurisdiction of the ICC then? Because it would be more direct under that we were participating in the war itself rather than just.
You have to specific war crimes occurred.
Right.
We're
quite pushed for time. I've explained this actually. The first question back here. We just have two more questions, but we need to be pretty brief. And then the second one there. We're put very pushed for time, okay?
Okay, it's not really a question, it's more just a comment. Just picking up from the last point that Adana made in her presentation, I think actually what's been very significant over the last couple of months, the experience that we've all gone through, has been a huge mobilisation from thousands and thousands of people who have actually started to think, to talk, to discuss, to question the whole ideas and theories and whatever. And even in a sense, I've been involved in political activism for quite a while,
but I have never seen after, in a sense, I'm not saying that the war is over, but in the way it's presented, after the war is over, still people are still wanting to discuss, want to move on. And I think that's very important, that at some stage, maybe not tonight, that we do see some way, some forum, whereby we can start to discuss how we go on from here, rather than just, you know, the static thing. The kind of slight disagreement with, and I'm not sure if Ivana mentioned it like this, in relation to the role of the UN, that the UN was set up as an opposite to imperialism. Actually, I don't agree. I actually think that the UN was set up as, the, you know, it was the victors of the Second World War. I mean, it's not that I was in favour of Hitler and whatever winning the Second World War, but it was the victors of the Second World War imposing their world view and their world order, and that I don't think the UN has ever been a body for world peace. Now, I mean, that's a debate that we should have, but it seems to me actually what was quite interesting about the movement over the last couple of months is the way that people themselves instinctively were beginning to come around to that view from the view of where we always used to say that the UN was the ultimate weapon in Ireland for peace. Lots of people were to say we are against this war, whether or not it has been an expansion. And I think that was actually a very important move in terms of the consciousness of large numbers of people over the last 5 years.
What I'd like to do is a quick question from Tim, and we'll see how we get on. If we can come back to some of this at the end, that's fine, but I want to make sure we get to the rest of the answers.
It's a quick point. Myself and others have tried to bring criminal charges against individual members of the government through Irish domestic law for things like aiding and abetting a war crime, and other parts of the law, such as you know, transporting dangerous goods, because, you know, we've been down there watching, and we've seen documents to the effect that cruise missiles, other munitions, including depleted uranium, are coming through Shannon Airport from places like Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska, and going to Kuwait and other bases. We've seen those official documents and stuff. Now, we've had nothing back. Some of them have been with the DPP for quite a while, and we're not expecting anything back maybe until Edge case decided. Now, I was just wondering, would charges like that, if they got, you know, just came back with no further action taken in our from the DPP, what could somebody legally do to try to advance those? Could those charged by aiding and abetting a war crime for the country that didn't send troops or whatever, but gave the runways and facilities, could those countries also be targeted through things like bringing them to Hague?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the DPP's decision is not constituted and not reviewable in our domestic court. There is a group of criminal lawyers, Lawyers Against the Wall, who did, of which I'm one, and we did their statement saying we felt that the Irish government's actions were analogous to criminal and domestic law. So, certainly, I'm aware of those complaints that you've made. Certainly, we have to talk about them. I think, you know, there are also the creative ways one can act, but I don't know how far one can get with that in the international ones. Just that on the UN, I think you're absolutely critical of the UN. I would be equally, and I'm effectively against the war in Afghanistan too, and that would, you know, and I would have been against the war in Iraq even had there been a second resolution. The fact there wasn't, I think, was another reason to be against it, though. The fact that they couldn't even get the United Nations sanctions tonight, which I think was one of the reasons why there were just quite so many people.
Okay, so we might come back to some of these issues if we've got time. We actually have an item between the first bit of the meeting and the second bit of the meeting. Nuria Mustafa, we're privileged to have with us. We would have had her actually earlier if she'd been here, but we're very glad that she is here. Would you like to speak for maybe 10 minutes? Iraqi, well-known activist, and great privilege to have her with us.
I was arrested at Toronto Canada Airport. If you get me to Toronto Airport.
Who's got a mobile?
Pull
me, guys.
Good to see you all here. I don't know, probably going to be kind of reflecting against all of us. I don't know, maybe a lot of us here are already converted, but it's good anyway. At this point, to kind of gather together and reflect and see what's happening. No, it's together, sorry. I've been really thinking a lot recently how what to do. You know, as far as the media is concerned, the war is over. As far as a lot of people here in Ireland who were very motivated and who went out to demonstrate, marched, many people who have never done so before, and they're quite disheartened. I've met a lot of them, and I've been in touch with quite a few people who are very disheartened, and they say, what's the point? You know, and in my own self, you know, as somebody who doesn't have the right to vote here, and I am still an Iraqi citizen, and yes, I have been active, I have been speaking, and there are a few other Iraqis emerging, dear friends out there. It's been a difficult time, even just the last week or so, and really, more and more I realise the journey is changing. I think it is a time where we are having, for a lot of us, we are moving from protesting to resistance, in a very real way, that it's becoming a reality that we actually need to realise this is the bend in the curve, this is where we're heading. And it is a responsibility. I don't know how to go about it myself, but it is something that I realise this is what's happening. It's gone beyond protest. Saying that, I wonder as well, you know, listening to Ed and Ivana about the way language has been hijacked. Our language, you know, the language that we're using in this room, other people are using in the States, in Britain, in other parts of the world where this war was waged, you know, in the name of words like participation. You know, I had a conversation with Minister O'Keefe 3 days ago, and he basically said to me that Ireland wasn't a participant in this war, and he would bow down to the decision of the court. And I salute your lack of cynicism. You know, that's basically where it's at. But do I believe Ireland participated in this war? Yes. I don't doubt that Ireland, you know, such a small country, took a part in the murder of, of tens, hundreds, thousands of innocent civilians in my country. Absolutely. I have no doubt about that myself. I am sure the victims don't have a doubt that anybody who assisted the United States and Britain is somehow complicit in this. The aerial bombardment has stopped. My country is under occupation, and it has a flavour all its own, even though I don't live there. I can't speak for the people there, but just from what I know from my watching my Arabic satellite channels. And on a daily basis, hundreds of thousands of people are demonstrating throughout Iraq, and we're not hearing that. I think that's quite a deliberate policy. It would be nice to think that this is just, you know, the agenda has moved on, and there is a bit an element of that, but I genuinely believe that this is deliberate. There is an agenda of a different sort going on. The language of fanatics and fundamentalists, that's the thing. So the people that the United States wanted to liberate a month ago are out protesting against the United States presence in Iraq now, but they don't count because they are fundamentalists. Iraqi religious leaders have been arrested. I didn't hear one mention of it in Irish media. Nothing. I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't listening carefully, but I actually didn't see anything in the press. Small articles by Robert Fisk, certainly, and Lara Marno, both of them did mention, but nothing on RTE, nothing on the radio stations. Up to 17 religious leaders have been arrested in the last week. Some of whom have disappeared. They don't even know where they're holding them. That's quite dangerous. For me as an Iraqi, I recognize that these are the manifestations of the United States policy and intent. It's becoming manifest. These people are there, they're demonstrating, and they're fanatics, they're fundamentalists. At the same time, there are cluster bombs which were dropped intentionally and specifically dropped on populated areas, and they're exploding almost every other day on Al Jazeera and Neil's little kids out in their backyard gardens, in the middle of Baghdad. I know these areas. And they're on film. Cluster bombs in hanging in trees, in people's back gardens, in ditches. Is this a war crime? Is this a war crime? Is this one of a number of war crimes? The fact that the warfare system was again targeted, even though they said they weren't going to do that, again the warfare system was targeted. A report came out of Yarmouk Hospital, which is one of only three hospitals open and functioning in Baghdad, that up to 10 children are dying every day. This is infants under a year old. 10 children, up to 10 children are dying every day. Not because of anything other than because of drinking contaminated water. Does this constitute a war crime? I believe it does. Now, the targeting of civilian infrastructure like water irrigation systems, like electricity supply boards, like communication towers, the complete disregard, the way that Iraqis have been dehumanized and completely really rejected. We are, the deaths, nothing has been said about the number of Iraqi dead soldiers. Nothing. 147 American troops died, and I recognize their humanity, and nothing has been said about possibly thousands, tens of thousands of Iraqis who've died, in horrendous ways. So it's a war in more ways than one, and I think most of us, all of us, are aware of that, but it is a war and I feel it. I certainly feel it. I feel it here. I feel it when people come up to me and congratulate me about the liberation of my country. And really, so it's a house. It's a difficult time for us here, activists or people who are interested, people who care. A lot of us, there are a lot of people. The reality is that things on the ground in Iraq are changing fast, and the Americans are hunkering down and doing what they intend. Things are going according to plan. They are. They might be a few days late here, but things are going according to plan. They are talking about turning on the pipeline to Israel. Are any of you aware of that? There's a pipeline to Haifa, which was turned off after the establishment of Israel in 1948. And the maintenance work is being carried out on part of this pipeline. This is horrendous. I'm surprised that people aren't screaming about this. Another thing was the fact that the media was targeted in Iraq. So this idea now that not only civilians, not only the target civilians, but the fact that we must, Americans and the British, must control what is out. What's out there, what we see, what we hear, that must all be filtered. So if you're not an embedded reporter, what the hell does that mean? If you're not that, then you are, fair game. The day before the Al Jazeera and the Abu Dhabi headquarters and the Reuters headquarters were targeted, the American troops asked four Al Jazeera reporters to step out of their car, and they blew their car to bits. Does this constitute a war crime? I think it does. And then the next day, they said, accidentally they hit the headquarters of Al Jazeera, then accidentally half an hour later Abu Dhabi, and then a few minutes later the headquarters in the Palestine Hotel. Are these accidents? Are these just another form of confusion that the Americans and the British are implementing? I don't think so. I really don't think so. I have heard news from Iraq, from my family and from other people, Iraqis living in Galway, in Dublin, who have been able to make contact with families here, and they are saying, we are under occupation, we are occupied, we are a family in Basra. And I know this, I can verify it, because Arab newspapers reported that during the war. There were many people selling fruit and vegetables and carrying water, trying to get into Basra in the first 2 weeks, and they were prevented, they were turned away by British soldiers. Now, as I understand it, that constitutes a siege of a city. And I think that's a war crime. So there are people out compiling lists of war crimes. They're shooting up civilians at checkpoints in their own country, 13 yesterday. 15 today in a school. in Fallujah. You know, the Americans said that parents turned up and started firing on them. The parents said they had turned up and they were asking the Americans to move to somewhere else and allow their children to go back to school. So, you know, 15 people died and dozens other injured. I just find it shocking and horrendous, and I, as an Iraqi and as a human being, waver between complete harrowing sadness and an anger. And I am trying to find a middle path within that, to find a voice and a way of action that will have some results beyond just a knee-jerk reaction, or beyond me feeling good that I have done something effective. And I genuinely am coming to believe more and more that direct action and civil disobedience are the way to go now. I don't believe protesting is enough. I really, more and more, I think that's the only thing we can do. Peacefully. We can do that. We are allowed to do that. In fact, we are obliged to do that. For our conscience, for our humanity, but even according to the law, we are obliged to do that. So, I haven't intended, I've written something else altogether here. usually happens, and I don't know, are my 10 minutes up? I just wanted to thank you all and ask you to not be despairing, not bow down, not be brutalized by the lack of care that the media is giving to them. Iraq is an occupied country. There are other concerns. That is right. But please don't forget about it. This is something that's just happened. It's just happening. We still can't stop that. Don't believe it when they tell us that we can. We still can do something. So I would just ask you and appeal to you to come together, you know, for all of us, any of us who are interested, to come together and work out and talk about ways of what we can actually practically do. And maybe it does involve breaking certain local laws here. But I don't actually believe that we will in the long term be held accountable. In fact, I think we will be starting a movement that will give courage to other people, as people like Ed and Mary and Kieran and all the rest of them, all the rest of the Catholic workers are doing. It's important that we do that, and I just wanted to thank you all for being here. Thank you.
Very privileged that Mary comes to speak. I'm sure there's lots, I imagine there's many questions. What I'd like to do is if we have time at the end, to come back and we can ask Mary questions on the two last speakers. Make sure we get through everything, then we have time for questions at the end. Thank you so much. Nobody's raised a really important point about disobedience. Well, my two principles came from the Second World War, and I appreciate the comment, the debate about these and how to view them. One, that disputes between states should be resolved peacefully if they could. And secondly, is the duty of citizens to take action to prevent crimes against peace and humanity. And it's in the Nuremberg Tribunal, where we're using it for campaigning work. But not only is it important, but it's very much under attack, this principle of the duty and the right to resist. We see it in many places. We see it in the three United States nuns who took action against a cruise missile thing, I think.
Minute missile.
Okay, thank you. They argued, and correct me if I get this wrong, that they had a right to do this under the Nuremberg Tribunal. It was ruled that the United States accepted that right, but they wouldn't allow it to make sense. We've seen the Patriot Act. There were 300 pages of extreme repressive legislation that went through 2 days after September 11th. It's basically wiped out civil liberties in the United States of America. We see it in this country, in the UK, in the redefinition of terrorism. It was essentially activism to change the government's policies. That's now going to be terrorism. So our ability to resist is also under attack. So that's my introductory comment. Again, it's a very privileged that two people are going to speak to us about their cases. Mary Kelly will start off, Kieran O'Reilly will go after that, and then we'll have questions for all three. Kieran will talk to the Catholic workers. I think all five are here with us, are they? Mm-hmm. Again, we're very lucky. All five Catholic workers accused of are with us. But I trust like Mary to start.
I'd like to thank Robin and Liz and the Fairview Anti-War Group for pioneering and bringing to life the Nuremberg demand. Okay. I did give you a short account of how I got involved in activism myself. I've spent years bringing up my own family. I have four children, and it was at about the age around 47 when I began to have time to notice what was going on in my own country. I've been away for some years, and I was very shocked to come back and find Ireland very deeply involved in the arms trade. And this was brought to light by groups like AFRI across 3 years, and then Amnesty International more recently. And in 1997 also, I first became aware that famine was the news that troops were going through, and I was horrified. I couldn't believe it. I come from a very naive position, and I went straight away and did a protest outside the door. That was about in 1997, I suppose. And there were five people who came with me. Joe Murray of AFRI was one. And I've kept in close contact with him throughout the years and admire the work of AFRI tremendously. And I especially admire them because every year they used to have the famine walk in Connemara. They had it going for 10 years. And every year on a certain day, they'd invite people to walk. I think it was about maybe 8 miles. And the journey that people were making when they did that walk, it was from one town, one little village to another. And it was during the years of the famine when people didn't have food, and they went to this big house to get food, and they were turned away and to go to another village. And this particular night, I think over 100 of them died. There was a huge storm, and they died that night. But as we pioneered that walk to make us remember our history, which we have forgotten terribly, and people walk, they bring people from around the world. I remember they brought the woman who had her skin burnt off with napalm in Vietnam, and they brought John Pilger just to try and make us aware of what is going on around the world. And I really feel it's horrifying how we've forgotten our own history of oppression for so many hundreds of years, and we've forgotten the fear and terror that was reigning here in Ireland. We've forgotten the hunger and how our children were terrorised. Because when you start to get in touch with that again, and what made me get in touch with it, I had to go to Palestine last year, and in fact this week last year I made my first attempt to get into people who were besieged inside the Church of Nativity. There was about 150 people there, and they'd been inside nearly a month, and I went there as a complete novice. I'd never done anything like that in my life, and again I was horrified at the amount of violence going on there, the fact of just being in a room like this and being surrounded by the sound of tanks, the terrifying sound of tanks rolling down the street, the grinding sound of them. And Adam, I'm sure you remember, I met Adam in Nablus, I know him since then, and I saw Adam beaten up by Israeli soldiers. I saw him kicked in the kidneys by, just because he was trying to take food into a refugee camp. I think it's very, very important that we as Irish people remember our roots, and that we have a huge responsibility coming from where we are, from our, as I say, our long history of oppression and knowing occupation, to do something. The position of being on our knees and praying and say, oh, what can we do? That's not good enough, and it's not good enough to give humanitarian aid. In fact, I think I find that an insult, and I've spoken to Iraqi people and asked what they think about humanitarian aid, and they find it an insult, as they do in Palestine. They don't want it. We have some sort of freedom here, and what they want from us is for us to speak out and use our position of freedom, that we're not going to be shot at for going on the demonstration, to do something about their position. Again, I feel our inability to look at, say, the oppression in Palestine and in Iraq, we create a huge gap, and we say, it's over there, and
turn off the television and get back to what we're doing, because it's very painful to really feel what is happening. And more than that, it's very angry making. And the thing is then, what do you do when you feel angry? And first I want to say here, congratulations if you let yourself feel angry. And I want to say congratulations to Paul O'Toole for saying that. Paul wrote some very important songs, and he's put them on a CD, and he went to a meeting that was on in Fairview where Dennis Halliday was speaking, and I just came out of prison, it was in early February, and I heard Dennis Halliday speak, and I know that Paul was at that meeting, and he told me later that he couldn't sleep or eat for 3 days when he got in touch with what is going on, and hearing someone like Dennis Halliday speak. Dennis Halliday, as we all know, was a member of the UN and then resigned because of how he saw it was being used. He's a very powerful, very common sense kind of speaker. And when you hear him, there's no way you can go away and not know what's going on. And Paul used his anger. He put it into poetry and song. He's written very powerful songs, and I'm delighted to meet him through the Fairview Anti-War Group. But anger is a very powerful key, because with your anger you've got a lot of power behind there. We power to make something happen. My anger drove me to I tried for years protesting and complaining to the police, and I didn't go the road Ed has, taking an actual legal case, though I did try. But I was driven to actually go into the airport and put an axe in one of the warplanes. And it was specifically because at first they were saying that the planes weren't coming, because I was at a demonstration last August where the police were saying, look, would you go home and have your tea? For God's sake, there's no planes coming in here. What are you talking about? This was last August. And it got to the stage where they eventually admitted it was happening, and then there was the question of weapons, and Tim went on prime time to challenge if it was going to be, was it Brian Cowan at that stage? He wasn't even allowed to go live in the studio. They transmitted him from Limerick and cut out a very important part of what he was saying. They wouldn't allow the real fight to take place and for the information to come out to the Irish public. So when I saw statements on the paper saying that James Brennan, the Minister for Transport, was somehow fiddling laws to make it okay for those things to come through, that's where my anger really came up, and I said I couldn't tolerate this, and I believe in direct action, and that's why I put an axe in the plane. I did it. I thought about it. I planned it. It was premeditated. A plane is just a bloody plane. It's not a child. I did not go and axe the limbs of a child like is happening in Iraq, and like we don't see half enough of, by the way, because these are the images that we need to see. And the Clare Champion was criticised recently for the kind of cartoons they've been putting on, and one of them was that they had I didn't see it myself, but I saw the letters complaining about it. Apparently it was about body bags coming through Shannon. And there were three letters complaining about how insensitive that was, that, oh, we can't have that here in Ireland. This is the reality. The body bags, the smell of death, and the dismembered, the terror. These are the things that need to be brought to our homes that we're not seeing. And that I haven't seen much of the newspapers there. I went into the library to read about Ed's case, and I was horrified that there's nothing about what is actually happening. And I'm glad, Noria, that you reminded us about the Arabic stations, because there's 22 of them, and here in Dublin, for £75, you can get a satellite disc, a disc that you will start getting that information. And and down in Cork, people go to each other's houses to watch those, the Iraqi people do, and we should be tuning into that more. I just want to say that I was at an anti-war meeting in Cork last night. There were 15 people at it, and there was great discussion about the fact that there's only very few people now going to the meetings, and how to help people through their depression and the sort of, this is how I'm feeling it myself, and I think we need to do things to jerk each other out of it, our helplessness. And in Cork as well, they're going to have a public meeting to publicise the Nuremberg demand, and we talked about getting people to Cork, try and get people like Ramsay Clark, who have, I just want to mention him because in 1992, he, 22 judges in the International War Crimes Tribunal brought 19 charges against the Bush administration. Now, this is the father of George Bush. And they found them guilty. They found the Bush administration and Bush himself guilty of crimes against peace. This was 22 judges, and it took place in 20 countries around the world. I only found that out today because I'm reading Ramsay Clark's most brilliant book. Now, this we're going back years about what America is guilty about years ago. Now, they were found guilty of corrupting the UN and using bribes to use the UN to threat and bully other countries. They were found guilty of controlling the media and directing it, manipulating it, and restricting media coverage to get support for their military and political goals. They were found guilty. Now, it's taken me today to find this information. I don't understand why there's not more people writing about these things, that there's not more articles about this being brought out now, and I think it's a very important thing that needs to happen. I'll move it on. Yeah, okay. I'd like to mention that tomorrow there's people from Cork in court in Shannon. They, there's a case on for people who the fence was pulled down in a demonstration. Was it last October? And of course,
it's in
Tulla. Oh, it's in Tulla, right. Now, I just want to mention that there is very, very little support for people doing direct action. Very, very little. And if there is 70 barristers and solicitors in this country who feel strongly enough to make a case and make a public statement to the government, I would like to ask them to come out and support activists who are in the front line. I know that tomorrow one of the people up in court has got a very heavy sentence in court 3 weeks ago. He was in court for going over the fence in the old head of Kinsale, which was open to the public, it's now a rich person's golf course, but he got 5 months sentence, suspended for 7 years. Now, if he goes into court tomorrow and he has Judge Mangan dealing out the kind of justice he's giving, he's going to be in big trouble. And what I want to say is, I've heard that World Airways is back in Shannon and the other airlines. They're going back there again. And they feel safe in doing that because they've got the activists very worried about court cases. And I'm in court myself, and the Catholic workers are on Friday, and we're, all our energy is tied up in court cases. And I would like to appeal to you, if you know any solicitors, please ask them to come out and take a prominent role. I think we have some great solicitors in this country. And I would just like to mention that in London, on the 13th of May, Michael Mansfield, who's president of the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers, in a room in Westminster, and several other lawyers, including Gareth Pearce, have called a meeting, and they call it This War on Terror Threatens Us All. Now, what they are rightly focusing on about is the threat to our civil liberties, and they say that normal democratic protest is increasingly prohibited or deterred through arbitrary police actions. In the latest incident, three coachloads of anti-war protesters en route to Fairford Air Base were kidnapped by police and sent back non-stop to London under close escort. Now, I'd encourage you, maybe if anybody knows anybody who could go to that meeting and make a connection with the solicitors there and make a strong link with them and make links with people around the world. And I just want to mention lastly that on the new bulk demand, I myself have sent it around the world and got an absolutely overwhelming response, especially from the Middle East, from Egypt, from America. And only yesterday, I've only finished responding to the amount of letters of support I got for my own action. I got 200 emails, and most of them were in Spanish from around the world. And people are looking to Ireland. And I write back and I say, I have great hope that here in Ireland we can try and get international law upheld. I'm not being naive because I've listened very seriously to what Ed is saying, but that is the challenge for us here, and we need people to do it. There's no point in looking anywhere higher than us people here. Thank you.
We've got 30 minutes now before we get chucked out. So again, I feel very privileged. Welcome.
Thank you, and I'll run it.
Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you, people who organised this. And I want to congratulate everyone for attending tonight, which is really a resistance to the lie, to the 24-hour news stations of CNN, Fox, and Sky, that the war is over. And it's as big a lie as happened in 91 when the B-52 bombing campaign ended and the war was supposed to be over then, and they went on to kill 1.5 million people through sanctions. And if I was serious about looking for weapons of mass destruction in that geographical area over the last 10 years, it was the sanctions that killed people. On page 8 or 9 today, it's revealed that the war demands of Al-Qaeda and why September 11th was carried out had been met today. The US military are leaving Saudi Arabia, 10,000 troops within the next week, and moving to Qatar. The Crusader troops are out of the Holy Land. That was the demand for September 11th from the people carrying out those actions. How September 11th has been used by the US military and the US government, of course, is to put forward every agenda, militarily, economically, politically, trashing the Constitution and clamping down on dissidents. So we live in very, very intense times. The war is obviously not over for us, Mary and ourselves, facing the courts. And I'd like to also mention Sister Artis Platt and Sister Carol Gilbert, Sister Jackie Hudson, who are minimally looking at 8 years in prison for their weapons inspection and disarmament action at the ICBM Solo in Colorado. They've been in prison since October. They weren't given a fair trial and have been found guilty of sabotage in the United States. Ulla Roda, who managed to get into the cockpit of a British tornado in Scotland following our action and disarmed that plane. Barbara Schmiedam, a Dutch woman who disabled 3 NATO satellite dishes in February. And Margaret Jones and another Quaker friend who disabled 35 vehicles designed to support and to arm B-52 bombers taking off from Fairford. And 3 British troops and probably many others who are now being court-martialed for resisting the war. Well, for these people, the war is not over. For the Iraqi people suffering amputations and napalm scars and destruction of their infrastructure and now the privatisation of their infrastructure by US corporations, the war is definitely not over. So it's just wonderful that you're gathering like this when 24-hour television tells you to go home, become a consumer, to believe that the only freedom you have in this society is a choice between Coke and Pepsi. They don't want you to be a citizen and have any concept of civil liberties or curiosity about how the world is run. We're a humble community. We're very humble. We're not spectacular, heroic people. We're kind of an interesting community because we kind of come from all sorts of the Irish experience. Deirdre Clancy here is from Dublin. Damien Moran is from Offaly, from the Midlands. Newen Dunlop from the Irish diaspora in the United States. Karen Sullivan from the diaspora in Scotland. And myself from Australia. It's interesting, we spring from 3 of the states, considering Scotland is obviously occupied. that were so complicit in this war. Australia. And the only, I think, Iraqi person I met before meeting And you were at a Halloween party in Galway a few years ago. I was in Darwin prison, where I was in jail there for disabling uranium mining equipment. And he had fled to Australia, fleeing the sanctions and the war, the economic war Australia and Britain and the United States was waging. And Australia was detaining at that time, and still does, thousands of Iraqi and Afghani refugees. The Australian government tells you that they're all interested in liberating Iraqi people. Just picture those people in the outback detention camps run by US private corporations. So we're a very humble group. We're just kind of met, really. I came to Ireland this time last year, just in time to be introduced to the Garda at the May Day reclaimed street, and see their kind of embrace of democracy, etc. And we're through the month of last year actually meeting Mary as she spoke her experiences of the Church Nativity and sharing the house I was living in with Mary for a month or so, and really hearing those stories from Palestine, being awakened out of my slumber. Because all they want from first world people is our slumber, our sedation and our silence, as they move their munitions through Shannon, as they press their buttons from far away and kill people like Iraqi people, like Guatemalan people, like Colombian people. That's all they demand from us. And it's very important, and the first thing we did, I think August of last year, after Daniel Berrigan came, Dan, of course, involved in the draft board raids in the 60s, helped initiate the clash as witnesses with his brother Philip in 1980, and spoke here and spread the word about plowshares. We began to vigil once a week, and we still do that at the GPO on Monday. And to vigil is to stay awake. As the whole society and media are encouraging you to slumber and sleep through these high crimes, vigiling is about remaining awake. So we would act and we would reflect and we'd try and build some kind of community. And I think it was the last week of October I met Deirdre, when Carmen Trotter from the New York Catholic Worker came over to do his Elvis impersonation here in Dublin. And a couple of weeks later, as we did a demonstration outside the US Embassy, I met Damien on the anniversary of the killing of six Jesuits protesting the School of the Americas. On New Year's Day, I met Nguyen Dunlop, a Catholic worker from the United States, and Karen and I go way back a few years. We gathered initially to go down to Shannon, the beginning of December, to join others in a day of nonviolent resistance. It was a few days after Phil Berrigan had died, and we transformed a sculpture in there from memorial to Phil. Phil had spent 11 of the last 30 years in prison for nonviolent resistance to the US war machine. And that was a very beautiful action, a beautiful experience. And once we act, we must gather again and reflect, and then act again. And it was in late December, I think, that someone, I think Deirdre or someone, sorry, proposed that maybe we should explore the prophecy of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares. And what was obvious to us last year, that Shannon had become a pit stop for the war machine. As Mary said, it was covert. It was hidden down, you know, the back blocks of Ireland. People were pretending it wasn't happening. The government was lying about it. And if anything can be said after our acts of resistance there, is what was covert is now overt. Shannon, a military installation, is now defended by the US, Irish Army and Navy. I didn't even know we had a Navy. But it is a militarized installation now, and it always has been, but it's been made overt. We feel that we obviously, you know, before the courts, possibly looking at a number of years in prison, we feel the charges should be dropped against us, that the environment has been polluted by slander, by the Taoiseach, a number of ministers, and Haas, the ambassador to peace, ironically enough, to Northern Ireland, who all lied about us, slandered us, said that we assaulted and hospitalised the guards. Within 6 hours of our action, the guards put out a press release saying no guards have been assaulted or hospitalised. Yet that lie still echoes through the media. We feel that we have no chance of a fair trial in Ireland, and the charges should be dropped because the environment has been polluted by the Taoiseach and by the ministers. We feel that we're acting under divine mandate to love our enemies, not to incinerate their children. And that's our basis for acting. We also agree with this group that under the Nuremberg principles, that citizens have responsibilities to act against crimes against humanity and genocide. And that's what we did. And, you know, in the tradition of the White Rose conspiracy of Sophie Scholl, who was decapitated by the Nazis for her resistance during that period, Franz Jagerstatter, decapitated for refusing the draft, all those wonderful unnamed German people who existed during that period, we acted in that tradition. We believe that we acted in the context of international law, in terms of defending the Irish Constitution, because even us born in Australia or America or elsewhere, we were raised with these ideas that Ireland somehow had learnt from imperialism, that it would stand as a beacon against the imperialism of other countries, and that its neutrality sprang from that experience. And obviously, it's news to us that was fictitious in terms of the government complicity. So it's been a very interesting experience with no resources. The vehicle we actually travelled down there couldn't actually cope with all of us, and Karen spent most of her time in the boot. The day of the action, we actually walked to Canada, and with simple household hammers and a mattock, a farming implement, we were able to disarm the plane that had been repaired at 6 p.m. the previous night. And through a number of coincidences, Mary's action the week before on the same aircraft, the transport minister getting up on the late, late show and saying, we've learnt from a mistake, security is totally taken care of, and of course disarmed for the second time. And then Hass arriving the next day, enormous embarrassment by Cowan, etc., the overreaction of deploying the Irish Army. And then the sycophantic offer to repair the plane. This is a prophetic action in our tradition. And what prophecy is about is pointing to trends in the present. You know, 50,000 troops going through Shannon on their way to battlefields in the Middle East and easily predicting what that future will be. A lot of dead children, a lot of destroyed ecology, and civilization kind of reduced as what we're seeing at the moment. You know, the images of looting, the retail looting that's going on, is only the beginning of the wholesale looting that will be carried out by US corporations and the military. So that is part of prophecy. The prophecy is interplay between the present and the future. And the other part of prophecy is to imagine a society of peace and justice and reflect it now. Start feeding the hungry. And start visiting the imprisoned. Start disabling weapons of mass destruction. So, and as with all this stuff, you know, and with the Berrigans especially, and their long lives in resistance, their only crime is that they're ahead of their time, basically. And what the mechanics of the judiciary and the prison system, and I've spent over 2 years in prison in a number of countries, what it's all geared up to do is to isolate the resistor, to say, you know, no one cares, you're irrelevant, you're a joke, you know, a new story on the horizon. And the only thing we've got is about combating that, really, is a sense of solidarity, you know. And in my 25-year experience of non-violent resistance, it can be the most empowering experience of your life or the most disempowering. It's all got to do with people like yourselves standing with those before the courts and in the prison system. And it's a terrible, terrible time, but it's also a time kind of, you know, pregnant with possibility, really. It's a time where if we don't do what television tells us, if we actually learn from the experience of the last few months, it's a time where we can gather in solidarity, listening to the voices, you know, from Palestine and from Iraq and from Colombia, and become better human beings in resistance, and not to be reduced to first world consumers. So we invite you to journey with ourselves and with Mary and with other people who are before the court. We left a newsletter that's got all our contact details, etc. The government has got us signing on at a police station every day. They have not released what they call the damage or the disarmament estimate on the plane. They've attempted to stall the trial until the anti-war movement dissipates. They attempted at one point to avoid a jury trial, not confident of the conviction. Once these issues are put before the conscience of the community represented by the jury. So it's an interesting time, and we really invite you to travel with us through this experience, hopefully through our acquittal or our further imprisonment. And it's a wonderful symbol the Ploughshares movement has mustered, whether it be in England or the States or Australia over the years. And thanks so much again for coming tonight. Thank you.
very much. We have about 10 minutes for questions for last three speakers. And I'll suggest we talk about what actually we can do to support them and to keep fighting this aggressively against all of us. But nevertheless, we have 10 minutes for questions and suggestions. And at the back.
Just first say to Maria, instead of hoping to hear somebody come from outside the country and to rescue the language, you mentioned the perversion of the language by our politicians, and to have somebody from outside coming to rescue us for us. I want to talk a little bit about what's going to happen now. I'm a member of the Ferry Group of the Irish Anti-Womanist and also the Encounter Group, and there are a number of things that we're planning. The Irish Anti-War Movement, Kieran Dutton plans to dissipate, we'd be glad to hear. And we're organising a series of meetings further from this. The Fairley Group has a meeting next Wednesday. The Drumcondra Group is also organising a meeting. And nationally, there will be a meeting on the major tents in this building on where does the Irish Anti-War Movement go. And I think it's very important that we are not going away. We are not going to dissipate. I don't think the feeling in the country has dissipated really. So I would be very hopeful that there'd be the basis for a movement that's going to go forward and not to dissipate. One example of what we're doing in the Congress group is we're challenging some of those politicians that have perverted our language. We had a protest at an opening or a launch of a book by the Minister of Education and Science, and before we even got to make any sort of a statement, we were thrown out. I was physically assaulted by the staff of the place that organized this meeting, the Marino Institute. And but we have now engaged them in a debate, and in fact they are now going to provide a hall for our next public meeting. So there is things that can be, there are things that can be done, and you can win the argument. We have reason on our side. And just one very quick comment to this, Nuria. I agree absolutely with you that we have to move on to peaceful civil disobedience. But there is an election coming up next year, and in the next election you actually can vote. You are enfranchised to vote in the all residents of this state, regardless of their nationality, are eligible to vote in local elections, and next year there are local elections. So please register your vote as well. Iraqis, anybody, Americans, Australians, everybody. So register your vote and use it as well.
Thank you. Please try and keep it quick, if you could. I'd like to know, that the focus at the moment should be on setting up the rule of law in Iraq. And I think that Mr. Corbyn takes with grace the fact how even the most civilized of people can be duped by government so that the rule of law can be taken away from us. And I think that's critical right now that America does not have this excuse of chemical weapons or an awful dictator. And I think that opens the door to people going in there and attacking the problem of, what is going to be the regime there, and how can we assist the Iraqi people in taking ownership of their property and ownership of their own civilization again. And I was involved in the Carrick Mine case, and I'd be happy to go to Iraq or to talk to people who would be interested in going to Iraq or working towards that from here. And I think that that's where the focus should be, not so much on the Irish people, but on the Iraqi people.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I've been saying, I actually plan to go to Iraq in the next 6 to 8 weeks. Inshallah. And I agree with you as well. Iraq doesn't need aid at all. Iraq is a rich country, but they do need medical assistance at the moment. And the idea is, we're hoping, there's actually a group of Iraqis, and we are trying to get a medical aid convoy to go to Iraq in the next 6 to 8 weeks. So we've just been working on this between ourselves and the Iraqi families. Hopefully we're going to open it up now, and I am actually opening up, and I've not spoken about it in public before, so I'm throwing it out there. We need help, we need publicity, we need money, we need donations of a refrigerated truck, we need medication. So that's the other thing that you were saying is Jay Garner in his speech yesterday said it is a big responsibility to lead people into life. There's this paternalistic patronize the attitude that they are in the light and they are leading the Iraqi people who are in darkness into light. And the arrogance of that resonates with me, and I'm sure with other Iraqis and non-Iraqis, that we do not, as Iraqis, we do not believe we were in the darkness of Saddam Hussein, who was supported by them. We were in that darkness, absolutely. And that I need to make that clear, that I am someone who has always spoken against Saddam Hussein. And I just need to finish that. As Iraqis, I actually was very inspired that people in Iraq, after years and years of repression, 35 years, haven't lost their soul. And that is the power of the human spirit, that they are marching there after 35 years of repression. I thought they're just going to lie down and accept, and they're not. And that does need, we do need to remember that, and we do need to take inspiration from it.
Can I just add a point, and that is, so I happen to be the longest serving political prisoner of the last Gulf War in the United States, which served 13 months in jail, before getting the more traditional punishment of transportation to Australia. Being part of the community that's time the B-52 bomber. And actually, more serious resistance came out of the US military in that war. 400 troops court-martialed and sentenced to 6 months, 6 years, then came out of the peace movement in the United States. Most of those troops went to their court-martials alone. The peace movement had collapsed quite about 3 weeks into the bombing campaign. We have to look after our resistance, you know, because the changes have to happen at the centre of the empire, you know, where the apathy is, where the consumer is, etc. Whether it be Australia or here or the States. And it's very, very important. There's something like 18 people on file, their non-violent resistance, the Irish complicity in this war, and we have to accompany them into the court and share the punishment, share the deed. In terms of our group, I think at the moment, possibly I'm the only one with an income. I'm working at a homeless shelter. Two of our people can't get welfare. We've been put up for different people, etc. So we're in a bit of need in terms of getting through the day. We're keeping the resistance going. Two of our people broke into Shannon on Good Friday and built a shrine to the Iraqi dead and planted a bed of potatoes, and we're in there for over 2.5 hours. The guards lied about that as well, because they caught them within 15 minutes. We're saying the best way you can offer solidarity to us and Iraqi people to continue the non-violent resistance will be in proactive solidarity with those who are.
How much is it going to cost their tourism? How much is it going to cost the Olympic Games, you know, if they lose their kids? And how are we going to help? And secondly, why aren't we doing something about this rotten media that we have here in Ireland to bring them to task? I put off my subscription to the Sunday Independent already. Can we do something
like that? I can answer that.
We've got the ability about finding the remaining on Thursday the 15th of May, as it's been asked by somebody, there is a fundraiser for non-Bazalini and Fairview Group. It's in the Anthony House North Strand. It's almost facing the Fairview Station, upstairs, from 9 o'clock onwards. Tickets would be £7 for unemployed or students, €10 for those who work. Please, we need your support. They're going to need the money for the court cases.
All six are going to Ennis to appear before the court on Friday. Every time they go, there is a media event. A circus to show the criminals walking through the courts, being taken and all the rest of it. But the cameras are there. So it's an ideal opportunity for those who can to go with placards, to go with their own statement, turn Nuremberg into something and those cameras into something that is positive, reflect back to the people looking, you know, at the television coverage that night, that actually these people are law keepers. These are upholding international law. So we should in every way try and reflect back what is the real truth and reverse the lies and make use of the cameras in whatever way we can turn it around. So I think we should try and get, as far as possible, people who are in that area, the Midwest group, the Galway group, the Tralee group, to take note that the cameras are there, These people obviously need support, and this is something very concrete that can be done, and done with some real effect.
I've got two announcements. One is we need money just to cover the room, if nothing else. So we're great that people come to whatever they'd like, and any extra book will be given to the prisoners and their defence. So please do that on the way out. We should keep the bit quite low. There's an action being planned after this meeting. I'm not sure if it involves gathering in the pub next door.
Is there a location for the Shannon Peace Camp?
Anywhere
around Shannon.
I really would like to thank our speaker for having me. By the way, if anybody wants to meet up, I'm going to have a look at the transport.